Kidney Center podcast. You're listening to The Edit with Sharon Dempsey, Emma Devlin, and Neve McCann as they discuss the progression of their respective PhDs and share some works in progress. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to The Edit, part of Heaney's Half Hour, brought to you from the Seamus Heaney Centre, along with the wonderful people at SARC, with a special thanks to Georgios, who's recording us today, and Susie for producing. Our show will endeavour to delve into our diverse research interests, exploring our creative research practice and where it fits in the cultural landscape.
Yeah, so as Emma said, today we're recording this episode in Queen's absolutely amazing Sonic Arts Centre. If you're not aware of what that is, it's a centre for interdisciplinary research into music and sound. And I would highly recommend going to any of their concerts, performances, whatever they have on downstairs in the Sonic Lab, because it's an incredible space. There's like 48 speakers down there and you're surrounded by sound on all levels, and I would really highly recommend it if you haven't been. They also host kind of festivals and things down there, so there's lots of really interesting things on, and they're at the real cutting edge of sound fun. Yeah, it's great.
Absolutely would second that, Neve. Like, I was at an event a while back before the great sickening that we've all had to endure, and it was really wonderful because it was an insight into like non-human perceptions of space. It was about, you know, you were walking around with the speaker on your head and there were other speakers around the room and they would buzz depending on where you were in the room, and it was really wonderful. And it was kind of this really nice reminder of interdisciplinary sort of roots to the same field. Mm-hmm. So yeah, absolutely would second what you mm-hmm. said.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because the event, I've been to a good few events in there, but the one that really sticks out for me was it was Stephen Sexton, and he teamed up with an artist who uses AI to produce artwork.
Oh, cool.
And Stephen had written poems and like fed it into this AI system, and they projected what the AI had come up with. So they had taken all the Wikipedia information of all the art that had ever been like made, and the machine just made these paintings, like these moving images, and the sound was coming from everywhere of like his voice, and it was just an incredible experience. It was actually a bit like overwhelming. Mm-hmm. It's like a sensory overload sort of, so be prepared if you're going into that space and don't have anything in your pockets that's going to like fall out, because it'll just fall down through the grid. Yeah. On the floor, and it'll be not lost forever. I'm sure they would get it for you if it was important.
Plus you get that sense of vertigo as well, of just walking across that floor.
Yeah, like totally disorientating, but in a good way.
Yeah.
I'm really pleased to hear that we've mentioned our buzzword today twice, interdisciplinary, and three of us are coming towards the end of our PhD experience. And we've all sort of in our own ways reached out to other departments and worked with other departments. How important has that been to your research, Emma? I'll throw that to you first.
It's been pretty vital, actually, because my project is by its very nature interdisciplinary, because it's got an environmental focus. So my secondary supervisor is from HAP, my primary is from AEL. So that by its, you know, you can't really escape the interdisciplinary nature of it. So yeah, and what that's done is it's kind of imbued a sense of, it's brought in sense of like a sense of history, politics, sociology into a wider creative project, which I'm not sure I would have been exposed to necessarily had I stayed in the one school. Not to mention sort of the sense of green politics and all of the kind of stuff that's specifically vital to my project. So yeah, I'd say that it's had a huge impact on what I've done as a creative writer. So it's also a sense of work that suits me, in that that's how I work. I like to sort of absorb things from different areas and see what kind of like swirls together in the big pot or whatever of my creative. I'm really going through this metaphor here, and I don't think it's working. It's been really important, I think, and I think it's something that I think is vital for a lot of research now, because we are entering a more interdisciplinary mood, I think, as an academic sort of field.
Definitely, I agree. And Neve, being a script writer, you've got to think about how the words live beyond the page, how mm-hmm. that is shown on screen, and then the sound as well. So in a way, your work is interdisciplinary.
Absolutely, yeah. And like my critical kind of shows that as well. I'm delving kind of into psychology and behavioral psychology and trauma and memory and kind of sensory stimulus and how that's arranged within your memory to construct your your personality and who you are in the world. So like mine's ticks a lot of different disciplines, which can be a bit of a struggle for me, because then I find it really hard not to go all the way down into that discipline and try to know as much as I can about it, even though I'm not a psychologist, but like I feel like I am, because I'm obsessed with how things work and how that, and I need to know everything about it. So yeah, interdisciplinary kind of study is the way I definitely work. And I think it helps when you're building a character as well, because you're thinking about them from so many different perspectives, and they're kind of, the sociology of them as well is really important, and aesthetic and painting and composition, and it's all like, there's so much going on in there in my work. And yours is the same as well.
Absolutely.
I'm sure.
And sort of thinking beyond this year, I had started thinking about maybe doing a postdoc, but it seems impossible at the minute. But one of the ways of making that work would be to look at other schools, and probably history and social history, and sort of delving into how other people do the same work, which is fascinating to me, and using their techniques. And just taking our creative work beyond the confines of the page. I find that really interesting, and want to see how far it can go, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's why like spaces like SARC and like QFT and the Naughton Gallery and all those kind of spaces within Queen's where people are exhibiting their creative output is really important, because it catches your eye. Even if you're not in that discipline and you go to it, and when you're there are other people there who are looking at all the same things as you, and they might be coming from history or biology or whatever, you know, like it could be anything at all. And then you get talking to them, or just even just seeing them there just kind of like confirms to you that you're not completely alone and not completely crazy, or like, you know, that you're going down an avenue that other people are looking at as well, but just from a different perspective. And you get a little bit of a sense of community, which I think we've all said before is hard to find in the PhD, because it's so, you know, isolated and quite lonely. Not to be so depressed about it, but
it's true, it is. It is, yeah. Something that kind of by its nature, like writing is something that you would do solitary. So to remind yourself that you are surrounded by people that are, you know, into the same things and are interested in, that there is something that they've also pulled on that you're interested in, it can be a nice reminder that you're part of an academic scholarly sort of community, and that helps, I think, you know, to remember that.
Absolutely, you know? And I think as a writer, you know, my work is within the pages, you know, it's confined, and it's an expression of something that has been part of my life for so long, and then I hand it over to somebody else and it becomes something totally different. But an exhibit space or on a stage, you get that instant connection that, you know, you don't get as a writer, and I'm starting to crave that, you know, and looking at ways how I can actually interact more directly with people who are consuming my work. You know, book events, it's just not enough, you know. I don't know where it's going,
yeah,
but I feel it has to go beyond just writing a novel.
Yeah, like almost like you need something throughout the process that's that equivalent, like, so you're getting a little bit of feedback as you go along from different perspectives.
Yeah, and I think that's what the PhD has done for us, mm-hmm. creatively. We're getting that feedback, whether from students or our supervisors, or just the work that we're digging into and then reflecting back on the creative practice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's scary about how we're going to let that go after these 3 years, you know. How will this affect our work going forward? Like, I don't know. Do you know?
I think, for me anyway, I don't know about you guys, but I'll probably crave things like this. Mm-hmm. Do you know? I think we'll probably, I'd love to keep doing this beyond the PhD, yeah. Because I think it is quite good just for creatives in general to join up with people who are just working in different mediums and on different topics. And I guess that's why people beyond PhDs and courses and stuff start magazines and workshops and stuff like that, you know. You mm-hmm. seek that out in your peers then, and don't want to let them go.
Exactly. And I think it's that shared practice, that idea that we're in it together, that there's a process. And, you know, if you're having a bad writing day, somebody will say, no, trust the process, it'll be okay, or have you thought of this, or you know, and you don't get that from anybody else in any other walk of life, you know. There was a really interesting workshop that I was asked to be part of during the summer. It's just come back to me, and it's software engineers from Queen's, and they asked a group of writers to come together, and of course we thought, oh, they're gonna use AI, they're going to write our books for us, you know. But it turned out that they were trying to look at how we worked as creatives, workshopping each other's ideas. And they said, because software engineers, by their very nature, could not do that. They were very insular with their ideas. They couldn't take on board critique. They couldn't work beyond thinking about something is right or wrong. Not that there were other avenues or different ways of thinking about it.
Sure.
And I thought, well, that's the beauty of being a creative, that we are open to that.
That's absolutely fascinating. I've never heard of that before, sort of people seeking us out. Well, not that I haven't heard of it before, but that's really kind of heartening to know that there's a quality to that that is sought out, you know, in other places, yeah.
And I guess, like, I don't know, sometimes universities don't, like, I don't know, they say they're interdisciplinary, but there's maybe not that much of a structure there to do that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And they maybe look to disciplines that are naturally interdisciplinary, like art.
Yeah, I think there's not enough.
To see how they do that. You know, like, how have you created that community so naturally without all those kind of structures in place? Or what structures have you built, you know, within your community that nurtures that? And I think there's a lot that the artist community can give to academia or to other kind of places that want to bring that in. You know, like, big businesses now want to have like art groups and things like that, and let's make a bit more of a community about their place, because they can see how worthwhile that is in any kind of progress being made within what they're doing.
I just think it all goes back to story. If you think of every human interaction is based in story. So if you go to the doctor, you tell the story of your illness, and they in turn tell you the story of their learning about whatever disease it is and medicine. If you go to the bank to set up a business, what is a 5-year plan but a story of how you want your business to develop?
Yeah, absolutely. And the imposing of narratives on things as well, like, you know, the narrative of the Anthropocene, how does that unfold, and the narrative of the political narrative and all sorts of different things. It's telling a story, and whose story is more important than somebody else's, you know.
Yeah, and trying to let other businesses, other industries, other sectors see the importance of the humanities, because we are being underfunded, under-resourced, overlooked. And, you know, you would have thought COVID and lockdown would have changed things, because how reliant we all were on story at that time to get through it, whether it was reading, podcasts, radio, television, drama. That's what we used as a crutch. But yet we come out of it and no, you know, nobody seems to have learnt anything
that. I do remember, like, in the early months, there was that sense of, like, when everything shut down and people were noticing things like clear skies and clear water and all that sort of thing. And they were kind of like, well, things might change. This might show us something. But then it just sort of, the writhing serpent of capitalism still wound its way around us. So I don't know.
I think a lot of people who realized how important those kind of things were for their mental health, though, kind of have held on to it, or like are eager to re-engage in some kind of way, or integrate it into their, I guess it's the integration into that capitalist model of how we can take what was so good when that all broke down and everything stopped, and we were like, okay, I actually really need this. This is really good for me. I feel more like myself than I ever have, even though we're in a crisis. Like, how do you integrate those kinds of things then back into normality? And maybe that's where things have been tripped up a little, because people don't know how to do it. But then again, that's asking people who have integrated that thing into their life, or made it their life, like artists or musicians, you know, and learning from them a little, because people have put such great value in it now for their mental health, especially in like kids and stuff. Times obviously kids' mental health suffered a lot during COVID and everything, so it's like, right, we really need to put something in place so this is integrated into school and work life, and like, how do we do that? And I think that's a big thing, because we constantly kind of talk about mental health in our in this PhD kind of journey, because sorry, you hate the word journey.
No, but it is a journey though. You can't get away from that. It's almost like that metaphor, you know.
Yeah.
It's our experience of it. But it is a journey. And when, you know, we were talking in the prep for this, looking back to where we were when we first started off. And you were talking, Emma, about digging out your original proposal, thinking about how far the project has changed along that journey, you know? And I think that's true for all of us.
I suppose another metaphor for it could be just like it's that old chestnut of like growth, because when I looked at my old proposal, the critical part had changed a lot, but the creative part had generally stayed the same. Yeah. What had changed about it was how rich it had become in terms of my research into, like, you know, how the Anthropocene works and all the things about flow and space and place and all those things that I wasn't as aware of before. So an enriching maybe might be more of a way of thinking of it as maybe as opposed to a journey, because it's something that stays with you, you know. You can leave the process behind, but the actual part of it would still be there.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope I don't have to do a PhD critical for every novel that I write.
That's true.
But I was looking back and my novel has more or less stayed the same, the outline, the idea, and it's been enriched, but the critical has definitely changed.
Absolutely.
Has that happened for you too, Niamh?
Yeah, well, my screenplay is still very similar in the characters and the world and everything, but there was a big shift kind of to kind of family ties and more about interpersonal relationships a lot more now, whereas before it was like this big sci-fi that was about like government conspiracies and, you know, like gangs and all this kind of stuff, and that stuff's all there, but it's just very much in the background now. And I think that's just, again, as you said, like an enriching, you know, like it's like that's just become world building, and then everything else on top of that just makes it more and more interested and more relatable to everyday people, because that stuff's a bit unrelatable. And then focusing on what maybe became important for me throughout the PhD and throughout COVID and stuff, which was those interpersonal relationships and family history and kind of niggling at traumas and things and trying to figure out how people cope with those and how they affect them personally.
That's something that we all do individually in different ways, is that we're striving to make the political personal. And once we do that, we're really getting to the heart of the themes that we're working on. The themes are the sort of the outer structure, and the characters, and that internal struggle is what makes it so personal, makes it so real.
Yeah, and it gives you a lot more, you can integrate your own experience a lot more into it then, because you can take things that you're experiencing in the everyday and thread them into characters. Whereas, you know, if it's gang warfare in a sci-fi world, I don't have much experience in that.
Not yet.
Maybe in my dreams or your dreamscapes.
No, that's interesting you should say, because there was a conference that we had at Queen's a few months ago, and it was looking at gendered violence. And part of my paper, I was so into writing this paper, and it was all about, you know, the body, the female body and victimhood. And a lot of what I come up with in that paper, I didn't want to just dispose of. So I ended up integrating it into the novel. And that's part of the excerpt that I will read later on this episode. But yeah, it's that idea that, you know, you experience something on the critical side and you want to integrate it totally. You can't let it go, you know.
Yeah, and that's something I think is worth talking about, is the relationship between your critical and your creative, and how, like, I was thinking about it today just coming to the studio here. When you're working on one side of it, say you're working on the creative, you know, are you banishing your critical to the back of your mind, or like, how does that relationship play out in your head sort of as you're switching between the two?
It's definitely a conversation. I think that the two parts of the one are in dialogue with each other. And questions that I struggle with, I'll maybe answer in the critical and vice versa, you know. And I usually find if I'm stuck in one, it's the best sort of process to just jump into the other side of it. And that has worked for me. And I'm really getting close to the end. You know, I've met my supervisor last week, and he's saying that intention to submit in March, which is really scary now. It's getting real, you know.
Yeah.
So, amazing. You know, that would mean maybe June submitting properly, with Viva being over the summer, maybe September.
Class.
Yeah, you say class, but is it really?
It's very exciting.
Because if you're at that stage, you know, like everything's working and everything's going to plan, and there's an end game.
Yeah,
there, your supervisor's hardly going to say your attention to submit's coming up if you weren't ready.
No, I feel ready, you know, but it's that fear of letting it go as well.
Yeah, but it will be with you forever. You always think back and you'll be like, I remember I did a PhD in this, and I know this now. You know, I know this, and this is how it's going to.
You say that, Emma, but I really believe the day I submit, I'll forget everything, and then it'll be a scramble to the Viper.
It's interesting you say that, because like one thing I did recently was I've submitted a paper to this open access journal, and it was based on research that I completely left behind in my first year. My critical project completely changed, but I couldn't let go of it. I still wanted to talk about this kind of stuff. It just wasn't going to be part of my critical anymore. So I wrote that up. So I think in terms of like letting something go and stuff, it's still going to be something that's going to like tug in your brain. Like, I know about this kind of stuff and I can talk about it. You know, it's about how you use it. You know, you might find that shifts a little bit, but it's still going to be there. There's still going to be an impulse of like, I made myself an expert on this, you know, and I have a position where I can talk about it. So I'm not saying, no, I'm just going to throw in, I'm not actually an expert on anything. So I'm just saying that, you know, in terms of like you talking about leaving something behind and becoming a doctor and then kind of like not sure how it's going to work, you know, that knowledge is going to go stay with you, whatever. I think it's going to be there for sure. Like, you're not going to just forget everything, you know.
Yeah, and I think part of the problem is that we don't necessarily know if we're going to stay in academia, and none of us have really made that decision.
Yeah.
Or it's, you know, will that decision be made for us that we don't stay in academia? I don't know.
That's it. I mean, there's so much going on, really. It was kind of beyond the scope of like what we're talking about now, but it's just, I don't know. I don't know if I want to.
Yeah, I think it's hard to make that call when you're still in such a long term project. And like, how will you feel about it when it's over? Do you know? Because I've known a few people who've been at the end stages of their PhDs. And they're like, never again will I do anything like this again. But I said that at the end of my undergrad and at the end of my master's, and I'm here. So
we'll probably said it at the end of my A-levels.
I mean, as writers, I know a lot of people that are like, I'm never writing again.
Yeah.
Except next time, because I got this really good idea for something. Exactly. And I have to work on it.
I know, if the ideas come calling, it's hard to resist. You know,
exactly.
So shall we share some of our works in progress that is part of our PhD?
Yes, sure. Absolutely. Can I submit myself as the first person?
Absolutely.
Mine is going to be the car crash of the three, I think.
That's nonsense.
I'm writing a sci-fi screenplay called The House We Grew Out Of, and I'm going to try and read a bit of it, even though screenplays don't really lend themselves to readings, so bear with me, it's an experiment. Okay, so this is the opening scene of my screenplay, and it's about my protagonist's mother character. So black screen, sounds, bird song and running water, the flap of wings, sharp exhales and long inhales, a loud crack, camera shutter, fade in. A bird's eye view of a dark green forest from above. A river winds through it. Water rushes over rocks. The river streams towards a steep drop. Leaves and debris hurtle over the edge of the waterfall and plunge into a deep pool at the bottom. The sound of water is inescapable. Lizzie, 49, stands still on a jut of rock at the top of the waterfall's edge. Her pale foot hovers over the darkness. It drips with water and paint. Her foot slowly rotates. The bottom of Lizzie's blue dressing gown is wet. The paint is seeping from her pockets. Lizzie, voiceover. Infinity opened up in front of me. It swirled with color, gurgled with potential. Compared to the ever more fading canvas behind me, it seemed so exhilarating. With so little to anchor me here, when it gurgled again, I have to admit, this time, it was overwhelmingly inviting. The water roars around her and underneath her. It drowns out all other sounds. Lizzie's eyes are wide open, unblinking. She pants heavily. Her chest heaves. A smooth circular pendant hangs from her neck. It glows with a soft light that pulses gently. Beat, beat, beat. Her chest heaves. The water roars. A long, deep breath in. Paint drips down her ankle. Blue, purple, red, pink, ochre. It mixes in the river at the base of the rock, muddying the water. Over black, birdsong and running water. The flap of silk. Short inhales and long exhales. Empty lungs. A loud crack. Camera shutter. Camera shutter.
Wow. That was so good. And it did work really well.
Did it, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I have to, in a screenplay, there's a lot of like practical information, mm-hmm. like scene headings and stuff. So I had to like just kind of skip over them. So I'm not sure, I wasn't sure if it was going to work or
no,
not.
No, it did work.
Okay, you thank know? You.
It did. It was yeah. great. It was like, yeah, it was like a...
So visual.
Yeah, it was like you're reading a short story. I was like, a certain
yeah,
point.
But yeah. I felt it was more immersive.
Yeah.
You know, for that reason that we were actually seeing it through, you know, like that screen. Point of view thing. Yeah. So, brilliant. Yeah.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
Yeah, brilliant. So, my extract is from a domestic noir novel called After the Party. It is loosely inspired or informed by the Ulster Rugby rape trial of 2018. And I examine sort of themes of toxic masculinity, middle age, privilege, so it's mainly told from the point of view of the victim and also the perpetrator's mothers. And this extract is from the victim's point of view. Katrina, my counsellor, has suggested I join a group. They're women who've all experienced some sort of sexual abuse, she said. Sometimes hearing their stories of how they've survived and thrived is worth more than listening to me. I take the leaflet and shove it into my pocket with no real intent of going. But somehow, on the day of the meeting, I find myself walking up University Square and on to cross the road at the traffic lights where the new Students' Union building looms in its boxy glass form. Without giving it too much thought, I find I'm on Elmwood Avenue, looking into the doorway of the building, number 45. There's no sign, no luminous light announcing what's going on inside. Like an AA meeting for victims. Victims Anonymous, if you like. Hi, come on in. We're just about to start. She has rose gold hair and a nose ring and greets me with a smile. I'm just setting up. We should have a few more before too long. Help yourself to tea and biscuits or coffee if you prefer. She's so ordinary, so accommodating and welcoming that I find myself shrugging off my coat onto one of the chairs and helping myself to tea. Before long, the room fills up. Women, some my age, some older, all mull around chatting before the meeting is called to order. The one with the dyed hair introduces today's guest, Enya Windig, who's a feminist writer. We listen enthralled as she talks about dead girl tropes. Her society has been conditioned to accept women as archetypal victims. She talks about true crime narratives and why we find them so appealing. Quotes Edgar Allan Poe and something about the death of a beautiful woman being the most poetical topic in the world. Then she stops, mid-presentation, and asks if we all know the story of Little Red Riding Hood. Yeah, we know it, a murmur. Of course we know it. Well, she says, we are Red Riding Hood. When you were a child hearing that story for the first time, can you remember what your instinct was? It's the same instinct we feel when we watch a horror movie and watch the lead actress about to go down to the basement. We shout, don't do it, someone says. We all laugh because we all recognise that sense of knowing dread, that only something bad can happen. Yes, says Enya, exactly. You want to shout, don't do it. Don't go into the dark forest. Don't go down to the basement. We are that half-drunk girl walking home alone. We are said to have placed ourselves in danger. No one shouts, don't do it, to the attacker. She lets that thought sink in for a beat and we all feel it. The energy in the room shift. We are understanding something so obvious, yet so out of reach that is enough to blow your mind. That there is an inevitability about what has happened to us. Then she goes on to explain that this supposed inevitability is what basically permits it. We are conditioned to be good girls, accommodating, making ourselves smaller and quieter so as not to draw attention to ourselves. But no one calls the men out. No one tells them not to take up too much space, not to talk over us, not to attack us.
That was great, Sharon. Sharon, can you tell us a little bit about how the, you remember you said about a paper kind of worked its way into that section. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came
together? So the paper was basically looking at the trope of pretty dead girls and how this is perpetuated in literature, in art as well, you know. So we have this male gaze gazing on the pretty dead girl, and we see it in television, we see it in a lot of crime fiction, which is my chosen genre to work within. So I'm always aware of it and always been uncomfortable with it. But through my work, I've come to realise that it is not our responsibility to look away. Instead, it is to really give our most penetrating gaze. Claire Clark, an academic, actually refers to that. We owe them our most penetrating gaze rather than look away. And I think it is allowing agency for the dead girl trope to then be able to say something about society and what society thinks about women and their bodies and how they often treat women and their bodies with contempt. So I sort of was going down that path of the pretty dead girl trope and wanted to somehow bring it into the fiction. And so I come up with this academic giving a talk.
No, it's great. And it's absolutely gorgeous writing as well, Sharon, as always.
Thank you. Thank you. I always almost feel that, you know, my work's quite commercial. As if I should apologise for that.
You know? That's a shame, Sharon. You shouldn't. Yeah. No.
I know.
It's very successful. It's hard as well, I think, to write directly about your critical in your creative. Yeah. I find that really hard to do. I find it really hard to work it in naturally, but you did it really well.
Yeah, I wanted to do it. You know, I set out thinking, you know, just for one little moment, I want the two to sort of meet.
Collide, yeah.
Yeah.
It's nice.
It works really well.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Now to hear yours, Emma.
Okay. So this is a draft of a story I'm working on called Abundance. It's based very loosely. It's a fictionalized version of a place I went to in the car when I was really struggling to write. And I sometimes think better in motion. So I kind of drove up north as far as I could go, just followed the shore road up and up and up and up. And I ended up in this place called Porkmuck. Portmuck, not Porkmuck. I was thinking of the pig there. No, Portmuck. And there's a sort of island off Portmuck. And Portmuck's at this really small little place. It's got this little harbour. There's this island. And it's quite this looming island. It's quite close to the coast. And I thought, that's a great setting. That's a really good setting. So I took that with me and kind of mingled it with a lot of research, just out of my own interest, into like language deprivation experiments. And then this is what came up out of it. I'm only going to read the first few paragraphs. Abundance. I answer the phone because I need to snap out of it. I am supposed to be mindful of compulsive behaviours. Today, that's the shelf straightening. Kneeling on the floor and spending too long lining up the soup cans, top and bottom, and then the loaves, and then the milk, then checking back, over and over, to put everything right again, because customers can't behave themselves. The phone rings in the middle of squaring up the freezers, and I realise I have my head in there, nose to nose with the cartoon pig on the ice cream. Be mindful of compulsive behaviours. Remember that thoughts are not the same as actions. I have been thinking about the old man a lot. I am due a break that I would be spending at the shelves, so I take the phone into the storeroom and lean against the wall. Hildegard Kelly, says the woman. I don't know who she is. Yeah, I say, but it's Anna now. I am afraid I have to tell you that your father has passed away. I knew it. Thinking so much about the old man can only have meant one thing. I paid someone to find you, the woman says. I'm sorry to tell you this way. She's probably someone the old man convinced to look after him. He was good at that. The woman seems to have prepared a script. As I am sure you know, Frederick did not consent to the jurisdiction of the commercial courts and was instead a common law freeman. So you must understand that there is no death certificate in accordance with his wishes for a natural death. I'm nodding at her over the phone. I'm trying to be encouraging. The woman sounds embarrassed. The old man had been variously a free man, a sovereign citizen, a survivalist, and a prepper. An unattached scholar, a free scientist. She's written it down to make sense of it, and she's leaving out the best part, the most pertinent part. He's nuts, she should be saying, and this whole thing is crazy. What's your name? I say. I do not like the sound of my voice, which has a tremor I do not feel. She sniffs. Clementine, she says. Nice, I say. He did not write a will as such, says Clementine. She takes great whistling breaths of air through her nose in the middle of words. But he did leave me a note with some of his wishes on it, and now I will read out the part that relates to you. Abundance Island, and all related materials, to my daughter Hildegard Kelly, provided that my daughter survives me. Let her dispose of my ashes there. Oh, and also I must tell you, Frederick has already... Oh, and also, I must tell you, Frederick has already been cremated. Frederick, I say. Yes, says Clementine, Frederick. The old man had never gone by Frederick before. He was Sammaticus for a while, for the longest while, thanks to the press, even after he changed it to James. They loved that. Sammaticus, Sammy, the madman who lived on an island and who didn't speak for 3 years. Sammaticus crops up sometimes in those True Life magazines. I put those ones to the back, out of sight, because there's usually a picture of me in there. The pixelated one of me at 5 years old in the back of a black car. Listen, says Clementine. I must ask you if you will take the ashes. He would like them scattered on Abundance Island. She has a quiet voice, but she kind of chokes on Abundance, and it comes out too loud. She's been waiting for it. She's probably got a note in front of her. Pause for effect, now that she said it. She spent time around the old man, all right. She seems to think that naming Abundance Island will make me lose my mind or something. Plenty of people do. Are human cremains toxic? I say. She doesn't reply, and I hate a long silence. Toxic, I say, to plants and marine life? The manager hates it when my voice lilts into a question like that. It signals a lack of confidence, and it's annoying. Nearly as annoying as the questions, it's the double checking and the checking. I'm always checking. I've done the right thing when I should already know, he says. Counting the change, recounting, recounting, asking if I'm pushing the right button on the till, and again, do I not know how to work the tills yet? Do I not know how to cash up? And the shelves, Anna. He's worried about me, he says. Very worried indeed. I have no idea, says Clementine. I am only a messenger. Sorry, I say. I have the ashes here, she says. They are very safe. He always communicated to me that he would love you to do this for him. A return to the land, which is such a beautiful thought. I hope you think so too. Maybe, I say. I have to get to work now. And we can talk together, maybe, she says, like I haven't spoken. She's off script. She's bolder now that she's under her own steam. About what? Frederick. Language. The island. That's my claim to fame. At one time it was all anyone could talk about. The foster parents, the police, the press. The 5-year-old girl discovered living in an old field shelter on a deserted island. That's my...
Wow. Brilliant. I want that to be a novel. It's not enough for me. I want to see what that was like, well, living like that.
I'd like to see what it would be about as well, to be honest.
And that brings us to the end of our recording today. Thank you, Emma. Thank you, Niamh.
Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you, Niamh. Thank you, Sharon.
And thank you also to Susie and Georgios for making this all work for us. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to The Edit as part of the Seamus Heaney Centre podcast. The Seamus Heaney Centre podcast was created in a small back room by Stephen Sexton and Rachel Brown. It was produced by Susie Bloom and features music by Connor McCafferty.